Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew DeClaire, and this is Equal Time for Free Thought, the show that promotes rationality, critical thinking, and scientific naturalism in the hopes of fostering positive social change. Today, our guest is author, neuroscientist, and philosopher, Sam Harris, who's here to speak with us about his new book, Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion, scheduled for release September 9th. Mr. Harris is the author of books including Letters to a Christian Nation, The Moral Landscape, Free Will, and a New York Times bestseller, The End of Faith. He's also the co-founder and CEO of Project Reason, which is a nonprofit foundation devoted to spreading scientific knowledge and secular values in society. So let's get right into it. Welcome to the show, Dr. Harris.
Thank you, Matthew.
So it's good to have you on the show today, and there's a lot that we have to talk about, so I think we'll just get right to it. And the first thing I did in preparing for the show was go to your website, and I read in the Waking Up section of that site, samharris.org, you wrote the following. Dear reader, I have been waiting for more than a decade to write Waking Up. Long before I saw any reason to criticize religion or to connect moral and scientific truths, I was interested in the nature of human consciousness and the possibility of spiritual experience. So my first question is, why did you wait to write a book like Waking Up? And why did you instead choose to focus on writing books such as The End of Faith and The Moral Landscape first?
Yeah, well, good question. It's somewhat an artifact of how my career as a nonfiction writer got started, because I was studying for my PhD in neuroscience at UCLA, and I had just gotten a toe into my research. I was actually studying belief at the level of the brain using functional neuroimaging. And then people started flying planes into our buildings for religious reasons. And so that 9/11 is what, the end of faith is essentially what happened to my intellectual career as a result of 9/11. I was immediately put my PhD on hold and started writing that book. And it just was clear to me from that moment that regardless of my other interests, the first order of business was to criticize and understand the role that faith was playing in shattering our world into competing tribes, and that this was a problem, really intrinsically. We have these competing worldviews based on irreconcilable revelations, irreconcilable claims that certain books were divinely authored and will stand for all time as the last word of wisdom, both ethical and spiritual. And so we really have to get a handle on what a problem that is, and how we just can't, the career of our species is not going to proceed indefinitely under the shadow of these irreconcilable ideas. And it's just we need to find some secular way of talking about our deepest experiences, our hopes, our fears, and everything else that concerns us. And we can't have our conversation about these things anchored to what was written to some or supposedly dictated to some person in the 7th century or in the 1st century or in 1000 B.C., and that's essentially what people are doing in the name of religion. So I had to get the criticism out of the way first before I could really talk about these legitimate experiences of self-transcendence and unconditional love and the other things that the baby in the bathwater that people are afraid of throwing out once you start criticizing religion.
Huh. So it's been a decade since The End of Faith came out, and now you have this new book, Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. Was the book itself something that you feel was not necessarily being written over that period of time, but was something that was evolving and changing over the past 10 years, or do you feel that it was something that you already kind of had this book in a way 10 years ago?
Yeah, I did. I don't know that I would have written it exactly as it is now 10 years ago, but it existed in seed form essentially in the last chapter of my first book, The End of Faith. The End of Faith became this so-called New Atheist bestseller. It was the book that kicked off this publishing phenomenon that's been called the New Atheism. But ironically, I never used the term atheist in the book. I never even thought of myself as an atheist. I didn't know what atheist groups were out there. I never went to an atheist conference. And I didn't intentionally not use the word in my book, but I just atheism was not a variable around which I had ever thought to organize myself. It was just obvious to me that using words like evidence and science and common sense and reason, these are the only criticisms we needed to use against religious irrationality. And so, but in the end of the book, there was a chapter on consciousness and the nature of spiritual experience and practices like meditation, and this ambushed a fair number of atheists who many of whom hated that chapter but loved the book for its criticism of religion. And so it's been there in my work from the beginning, but Waking Up is the book-length version of that argument. And what's new about it, I mean, what I couldn't have written 10 years ago is I really couldn't have anticipated the kinds of skeptical concerns that my fellow atheists would have with these phenomena. Because the problem is that the moment you start talking about, quote, spiritual experience, and altered states of consciousness and any connection between these things and our scientific worldview, you have to do a lot of work to disentangle them from all of the pseudoscience and wishful thinking that has freighted them for decades and centuries. So, and you have many people like Deepak Chopra and right. Eckhart Tolle and other New Age figures who are seeming to make the case for spirituality within the context of science, but they're doing a terrible job of it, and they're making scientific errors more or less whenever they draw a link between spirituality and science. So there's a lot of work to do to make atheists and skeptics and other students of science comfortable that you're not just smuggling in religiosity and faith-based thinking just merely by even raising these topics.
Right, and I understand that spirituality, as it's applied to this book, a great deal of focus is spent on meditation. Can you tell us a little bit just about your personal introduction to meditation? And were there any ways in which you had to distinguish between good meditation practices and poor ones?
Yeah, well, in my 20s, I spent a fair amount of time studying meditation in a variety of forms, mostly in a Buddhist context, but not exclusively. But I spent a lot of time in India and Nepal studying with various teachers, and spent about 2 years on silent meditation retreats in that decade, in increments of as long as 1 week to 3 months, where you go into silence and you really do nothing but meditate. You're not reading, you're not writing, you're not talking to people. You're just spending 12 to 18 hours a day, depending on how much you sleep, just doing the practice of meditation. And the practice I did in the beginning, and for the longest time, was a practice that will be well known to some significant percentage of our audience by the name of mindfulness, because mindfulness is now increasingly current, and it's been recommended to business people, and it's been studied scientifically. And mindfulness comes from a tradition in Theravada Buddhism of teachings called Vipassana, and Vipassana is the Pali word for insight. And the goal of the practice is to have insight into the nature of human experience, such that you can really, you can truly connect with your experience as it is in each moment, without judging it, without trying to change it, without trying to, without talking to yourself about it, being lost in thought about it, just merely being aware of experience in each moment. And mindfulness is that kind of non-discursive and non-judgmental awareness that you begin to train in, which allows you just to pay very clear attention without being lost in thought. And so on a retreat, you're practicing in silence, and for when you're doing sitting meditation, you start out just focusing on the breath. But then very quickly that technique just opens up to anything you can possibly notice. So there's nothing in principle outside of the practice of meditation. When you're hearing, you're noticing that you're hearing. When you're feeling sensations in your body, you're noticing them. When you feel various moods or emotions arise in your mind, you notice them clearly. And it's just, the goal is to be as clearly aware as possible of your experience and its character in each moment without being lost in thought and without grasping at the pleasant experience and pushing away unpleasant experience. And what you discover when you do this, the first thing you discover when you attempt to do this, is that you spend virtually every waking moment of your life lost in thought. And most people aren't aware of this. They may be aware of it in the abstract. They may have a belief that they spend most of their time thinking. But it is such a deluge of discursivity that people just are not aware of it. They're just, in the morning, they're just chased out of bed by their thoughts, and they have a continuous and unbroken conversation with themselves every waking moment, and their lives are perceived and experienced through this scrim of self-talk, and much of which is quite unpleasant. Much of which is judgmental and increasing our anxiety, and it's just we're not saying the kindest things to ourselves. And we're not saying the kindest things about other people most of the time. And if you could imagine just what it would seem like if your thoughts were broadcast on a monitor for everyone to hear, you would sound completely insane. I mean, the structure of our conversation doesn't make any sense. You're talking to yourself, and you're playing both sides of the conversation.
Yeah, you know, when you actually wrote about that in the book, it made perfect sense. It's just I had never really considered it quite so seriously before. And I wonder, from your perspective, it seems like in your early 20s and continuing to this day, you find that a practice like meditation, despite the fact that it is such a challenge and you have to be so devoted to doing it and to keeping it up, I would think that there are many people out there who would struggle to find the, not just the pleasures, but to truly understand the benefits of such a practice when that practice takes so much effort and so much time. Like you said, spending some weeks at a time over the course of about 2 years, that takes an awful lot of dedication. So what was it for you that seemed so worth it and so worth going for during both that period of time and trying to convince others to do the same now?
Yeah, well, it is a challenge because it does take, in most people's cases, it takes considerable training to really connect with the practice. I mean, it's a little bit like golf. You know, if you pick up a golf club, unless you happen to be Tiger Woods and you're, you know, 3 years old, if you pick up a golf club at any point later in life and try to act like a good golfer, you just immediately encounter this just pure experience of frustration, because it's hard to be anything remotely like a good golfer for the longest time. And yet there's no question that the difference between meditation and golf is that with golf you can actually see that it's just absolutely obvious that it's possible to be a good golfer. You can see someone else hit the little white ball 300 yards exactly where he wants it to go, and so there's no doubt that there is a skill set there that could be attained if you had the energy and talent for it. With meditation, it's all of these results are on the inside for the most part. You can meet people who are inspiring to one or another degree. You can hang out with the Dalai Lama and notice that he's happier than the average person, and you know, he thinks meditation is somehow important to that. But still, there can be a basic uncertainty in most people's mind about whether or not there is a there, whether there's really anything to realize or there's any significant change that can be had at the level of one's experience. But there's a few ways in that don't really require any faith, or if they require faith, it's in the form of just a scientific hypothesis. That the promise is, if you use your attention in certain ways, you will experience a certain result, and you can just try that experiment for yourself and see if it's true. But the reality is that unless you're very talented or very naturally very concentrated, the experience in the beginning is going to be one of basically, you know, you're sitting with your legs crossed and thinking, and you're going to be trying to pay attention to the breath or any other object of meditation, but you're going to spend virtually all of your time lost in thought. And the beginning phase of learning to meditate is to learn to distinguish between actually paying attention to whatever you're attempting to pay attention to and being lost in self-talk about it or about anything else that probably has nothing to do with meditation.
Yeah, I gave it a shot yesterday. There's a part in your book where you encourage readers to just give this a shot, even for a moment. And I found exactly what you're talking about, just a constant barrage of thoughts that it seemed would just repeat over and over again.
Yeah, and I guess as a matter of intellectual interest, someone can find their way in just by. But it's just a common sense starting point. If you want to deeply understand what it's like to be you, and if you want to discover whether there's anything about the mind from a first person point of view that is worth discovering and is liberating to discover, well then it makes sense to pay attention. It makes sense to closely observe this thing you call yourself in each moment to see what it's like. And all meditation is the effort to closely observe the flow of your experience.
Yeah.
Now, the fact that you find that hard to do and maybe even just lacerating to even attempt it because you're so restless and you just can't sit there, you can't sit still for 2 minutes, that could become intellectually interesting to you because it's how is it that you're such a person that you can't actually sit in silence comfortably and be aware of the flow of your own experience for any significant amount of time without checking your email or jumping on the phone to call a friend or just getting up and walking out the door. I mean, there's a discomfort that people encounter, which they could just be motivated by, and they could just run off and never have a backward glance at this project, or they could become interested in it and wonder why is it that they're finding it so difficult to pay attention. And if you get over that hump, if you get over your resistance to this, an inner landscape opens up where you begin to notice things about the nature of your own consciousness that were until that moment concealed from you because they were behind this white noise of thinking that you never really inspected before.
And I think it seems you make the point that one of the biggest parts, if not the biggest part, of accomplishing that is focusing on breaking down this internal feeling that we all have of a self. And on page 9, you write that the feeling that we call I is an illusion. So can you explain in a little more detail what you mean when you say that the feeling of self is an illusion? And I suppose in particular, what does it mean for a feeling in general to be an illusion?
Yeah, good question. Well, it's a little confusing because we use this term self in a variety of ways, and we often use it to mean essentially the whole person. So you're just, what you mean is your body and your mind, all of your cognitive powers, your emotions, your autobiographical memory, everything. That's yourself. Now, that's not the self that's an illusion. I'm not saying people don't exist. I'm not, am I really on the phone talking to you right now? Yes, I really am. I'm here. It's possible to talk about me as a discrete person in the world, and that's all fine. The self that doesn't withstand scrutiny is the feeling that we all have of being a subject inside our bodies, in our heads, a thinker of thoughts, an experiencer of experience that is a kind of inner agent. So most people don't actually feel identical to their bodies. They feel that they have bodies. They feel like they're riding around in their bodies as though their bodies were a kind of vehicle. And most people listening to us talk right now will feel that they are in their head, behind their eyes, in a way that they're not behind their knees. Right, their knees are down there. Their knees are their property in a way, but they're in their heads, and they feel like they, and therefore it's somewhat paradoxical to think of in what sense the rest of them is them. I mean, in what sense is your body you if you don't actually feel identical to it? Well, that's a strange situation, but it's not. The basic starting point is that you don't feel identical to it. You feel like you have a body. You feel like you're internal to the body, and you are in your head as opposed to some other point on the body. And if people have done studies where they ask people to judge when an object is closest to another person, and they've done this cross culturally, they've done it with kids, and if you put the object, you know, near the person's head, they judge it to be much closer to the person than when you put it near their stomach or their knee, and they judge it closest of all when the object is near their eyes as opposed to the back of the head or the mouth. So we feel like we're behind our eyes, and we feel like we are a thinker of thoughts in addition to the thoughts themselves. We don't just feel, we feel like there is a thinker that is in some sense authoring the thoughts. This turns out to be an illusion. If you look for this feeling of being located in your head behind your eyes, if you look for this sense that there's a thinker in addition to the mere arising of the next thought in consciousness, if you look for the sense that this just the sense that there's the subject in the center of experience that's appropriating the experience, it's not merely identical to the sphere of experience, that does not survive scrutiny. And if you look diligently enough, if you look closely enough, if you can break the spell of thought long enough to simply look, that feeling goes away. You actually can discover the absence of that self. You can discover that consciousness doesn't feel like I. In fact, that feeling of I, that feeling of being a subject internal to the body, is what it feels like to be thinking without knowing that you're thinking. It's what it feels like to be identified with the next thought that arises in consciousness without having noticed it arise as a phenomenon, as this automaticity of just language or images in consciousness. And if you can notice the arising of thought carefully enough, you can begin to notice what consciousness feels like in between thoughts, that is, prior to the arising of the next one. And consciousness, just the sheer awareness of that is illuminating your experience at this moment, the thing that makes it like something to be you, the sheer fact that the lights are on subjectively for you, that doesn't actually feel like I. And the feeling of I is itself just another object of consciousness. It's an appearance within consciousness. That's the only reason why you feel it in the first place.
Well, I suppose that this will be an attempt to solidify your point, because I was struggling throughout the book to understand quite exactly what the distinction was between consciousness and self, and it particularly became difficult for me on page 67. And you wrote about split brain patients, which I hope we get to talk about a little bit later on. But you say that, quote, the consciousness of the right hemisphere is especially difficult to deny whenever a subject possesses the linguistic ability on both sides of the brain, because in such cases, the divided hemispheres often express different intentions. In a famous example, a young patient was asked what he wanted to be when he grew up. His left brain replied draftsman, while his right brain used letter cards to spell out racing driver. Mm. And that to me, first of all, incredible that this is something that we've been able to do. But the problem that I'm having with that particular section is that it would seem to me that in order to understand or know what he wants, there would need to be some sort of sense of self, or one self even for each hemisphere, perhaps. And you begin this section by saying the consciousness of the right hemisphere is difficult to deny, but the examples you give seem to imply to me more than just a simple state of awareness. They seem to include a sense of self, a sense of what the self desires, thinks, and believes. So is there something that I'm misunderstanding here, and can you clarify for us the distinction between that sense of self and of consciousness?
Yeah. Well, consciousness, to talk about consciousness, I'd like to use the philosopher Thomas Nagel's starting point. Thomas Nagel wrote a very famous essay, arguably one of the most famous essays in the last 100 years in philosophy, entitled What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And his interest was not in bats. It was an essay entirely about how we understand consciousness conceptually, But he argued that this is it. That if you're asking about what it's like to be a bat, you are asking whether or not a bat is conscious. You're asking, well, if I could trade places with a bat, would the lights go out, or would there be some sphere of experience, however indescribable, however inscrutable, that I would then be opened up to? And if you think the lights go out and the trading places with a bat would be the same thing as trading places with a ham sandwich or a rock, you think that bats are not conscious. And if trading places with a bat opened you up to some sphere of experience, again, it might be something that you could not possibly put into words, well, then that would be consciousness in the case of a bat. And so we all have the intuitions of about what other animals are conscious and where we draw the line in the natural world. Those intuitions can be pushed around a lot by just how we talk about the problem. But it's pretty clear that we're not the only conscious creatures on Earth, and that chimpanzees and dogs and probably all mammals are conscious. And my intuitions begin to falter once you get down toward things like crickets and cockroaches. You know, whether or not they are conscious, I don't know. But we don't yet understand how consciousness emerges out of unconscious neural complexity. And there are philosophers who would argue that it doesn't, in fact, emerge, and that it must sort of go all the way down into the fabric of reality. And those descriptions of consciousness begin to sound a little spooky. But in any case, consciousness is a mystery in terms of exactly how it arises out of information processing or anything else. There's just simply no question that it does arise. We are all conscious. There's something that it's like to be us in this moment. And our brains are obviously intimately involved in this process. And it would seem that not every area of our brain is illuminated in the same way, so that most of what our brains are doing is unconscious. There's nothing that it's like to be certain parts of your brain doing their information processing, and yet some other parts of your brain clearly are sufficient to give you this first person subjective experience. And so it would be the experiments you reference, which are really some of the most astonishing scientific experiments ever done, and they're so astonishing, in fact, that we really haven't been able to integrate these results into our thinking about ourselves and the world. It's just when people hear about the split brain studies, and this is now, they were done over 50 years ago, the first ones. It's so inscrutable that people are interested for a time, and then they walk away just not having found any shelf in their mind to put these results on. But the results are more or less uncontroversial, and the results are these. People with severe epilepsy occasionally have a surgery called a commissurotomy or a colossotomy, depending on how many nerve tracts are severed. But they have some number of the nerve tracts that link the left and right hemispheres severed, so that the storms of unregulated neural activity can't move from one hemisphere to the other and engulf the whole brain in a grand mal seizure. So they have these nerve tracts severed, and initially when the surgery was done, it seemed that these patients weren't really changed very much by it. And it took a while for anyone to decide to study them closely enough to tease out what was different about them. But what was discovered is that because of the fact that the hemispheres are now divided, in particular because the corpus callosum, the main fiber tract connecting left and right regions of the cortex, was severed, information could be presented to the left hemisphere and to the right hemisphere alone, and you could interrogate them separately about their experience. So you could show, for instance, a picture of an egg to the right hemisphere. And in most people, the right hemisphere is inarticulate, and it can see things, it can read basic words, it can understand basic speech, but it's generally mute and unresponsive through language. So the left hemisphere is the one that is talking, and the one that can seem to be, can seem to be the most human, because it's the one that's going to give you an answer when you ask it a question. So when you put people in this paradigm where you're able to show them, for instance, images in their that are broadcast exclusively to the right hemisphere, any image in the left visual field in a divided brain will be seen only by the right hemisphere. Then you ask the subject what he just saw. Well, he, with his articulate left hemisphere, will say, "I didn't see anything at all." And then you, when you say, "Okay, well, could you just reach under this partition and grab the object that you may or may not have seen?" Then at that moment, his right hemisphere, now that has control of the left hand, can reach forward and grab an egg. And if you ask the left hemisphere, "Well, so what are you holding in your left hand?" The left hemisphere doesn't know what it's holding in its left hand, because it only has fine motor control over the right hand. He'll say, "I don't know." And then when the right hemisphere opens the left hand, showing, revealing the egg, and you ask the left hemisphere, "Why do you think you picked this egg?" The left hemisphere will confabulate. Almost never will it say, "I don't know." It will then confabulate a story that it finds meaningful, and the confabulation will be, "Oh, you know, I must have done that because I had eggs for breakfast yesterday." And this is a very reliable result. This is the result you get generally in people, you know, who have virtually all of their linguistic competence segregated to the left hemisphere, but that's, you know, 96% of right-handed people and about 70% of left-handed people. So most of us have our productive language capacity almost entirely in the left hemisphere. And yet, it's obvious from these experiments that the right hemisphere has a point of view. The right hemisphere is able to respond in a variety of ways. It follows directions. And in many, after these surgeries, in many cases, you get kind of an overt tug of war between the right and left hemispheres in these people. I mean, there are cases where someone's putting on a shirt, you know, with one hand, but tearing it off with another, he's grabbing his wife, to hug her with one hand, but, you know, pinching her with the other or pushing her away with the other. And so there are two points of view in these people, born of the fact that you have divided their cerebral cortices. A few people have resisted this conclusion. I think certainly most neuroscientists and the most plausible reading of these findings is that both hemispheres are conscious, that there's something that is like to be both the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere of these subjects, and it's not one point of view. You can't reconcile it as one point of view alternating. These are two points of view. So the consciousness has been doubled or halved in this case. And, you know, the left hemisphere doesn't know what it's like to be the right hemisphere in the same way that I don't know what it's like to be you. I mean, they are inhabiting separate points of view. And it's just a bewildering result, because what we are as conscious entities can be divided with a surgeon's knife. And there seems to be no doubt about that. And it opens on to some very strange philosophical questions, because then you're left to wonder, with an intact brain, I presumably have a totally intact corpus callosum. I've never had a surgery like this. But we know that the corpus callosum can't perfectly integrate information across the hemispheres. There's just not enough nerve fibers. 200 million nerve fibers is not sufficient to integrate the activity of 10 billion cortical neurons on either side of the longitudinal fissure. And so it seems reasonable to think that there may not be perfect sharing of consciousness even now in an intact brain. There may be some sense in which there are multiple perspectives in my own brain at this moment. And the question of which, you know, what that means and which one I inhabit, and what is potentially conscious and what isn't. I mean, it almost opens the door to kind of Freudian notions of the unconscious, where the unconscious isn't just the darkness of complexity in the brain that you can't be aware of. It's possible that there's stuff going on in you that you can't be aware of, but it's nevertheless aware of itself. And that's just almost too bizarre to be thought long and hard about, but it's, you know, it's one of the implications of this research.
Now I can understand why you spend so much time working on this sort of work. So for those of you just tuning in, I'm Matthew LeClaire, and this is Equal Time for Free Thought on WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm speaking with Sam Harris on his new book, Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. So we just covered a good deal of some of the science of this, in particular dealing with the issue of consciousness and the self. I want to get in a little bit into the problems that you will likely face when it comes to the main group that you're trying to address. As it says in the leaf of your book, this is designed for people who identify themselves as being not religious, but they are still open to perhaps the idea of something like meditation. But obviously, as you say in one of the first pages of your book, you talk about how the term spirituality may be a big turnoff for many secularists. And you talk about the etymology of the term spirit, which, as you say, it comes from a Latin, which is a translation of Greek. And you talk about how that term itself was twisted around and became entangled with superstitions at around the 13th century. And when I was reading that part, I thought back to your other usages of terms such as religion and religious, which there are other interpretations of what the etymology of that word is as well. But one very common interpretation is that it comes from the Latin religare, which is to bind, and that very much like with the term spirituality, it became tangled up with superstitions and the like around the 13th century. And I'm sure that you know there are people who identify themselves as religious or even religious secular groups like ethical culture and, depending on who you ask, humanists. So all of this is just to ask the question of, considering all the facts, why is it that over the past decade or so you have felt that saving or, should I say resurrecting? I guess I can. Resurrecting the term spiritual or spirituality from the hands of superstition and theism, but have decided not to save or reclaim terms like faith or religion, given that each one of these terms may be and often are interpreted in a secular light.
Yeah, well, I would certainly dispute whether religion is often interpreted in a secular light. I think it's what most people mean by religion is a set of faith-based beliefs, almost always having to do with a claim that one book was authored or otherwise inspired by an omniscient being, and it's just a suite of what I would consider unjustified and intrinsically divisive doctrines there that are accepted by virtually all religious people. So it's then attempt to shift the definition of religion to something more palatable, I think would be just counterproductive and just wouldn't be honestly representing the views of, you know, 99% of religious people. I'm not, as you know, comfortable with the term spiritual. The problem is just there's no better word in English to name this endeavor. If you want to take seriously the prospect of being like Jesus, whoever he in fact was historically, or like the Buddha or any other celebrated contemplative, if you want to appropriately honor certain very rarefied states of mind, states like unconditional love or self-transcendence or ecstasy, if you want to talk about the far end of the continuum of human well-being and talk about ways of training the mind so as to inhabit it, you need a word that's bigger than stress reduction or positive psychology, or you need something that links up with the traditional context in which people have attempted to do this, the yogis and lamas and mystics for the last two millennia have lived in caves and done various practices. Granted, virtually always in the context of one or another religious worldview, you need a word that reveals how deep this inquiry goes, and so the words like spirituality and mysticism and transcendence, and I mean, I haven't found truly secular equivalents for these kinds of words. And so spirituality is the one I use, and contemplative is the one I use a lot. But
right.
Yeah, I mean, these words freak out atheists, and for for good reason, because it's not just their etymology. It's what most people mean by them most of the time. I mean, it's true that 20% of Americans define themselves as spiritual but not religious, and it's those 20% that seem most open to this kind of dialogue. But what most of these quote spiritual people mean by spirituality is very often conflated with quasi-religious ideas or just bad ideas that are clearly as indefensible as most religious doctrines, whether it's a belief in astrology or the healing power of crystals or certain alternative medicine that makes no sense. I think it's just crucial to talk about specific beliefs and the evidence and arguments in their favor. And so I mean, I'm also someone who doesn't equate all religion, unlike many atheists, I don't talk about religion in general as though all religions are equally bad or equally divisive or equally at odds with modernity. I mean, religion is a word like sports, and there are sports like mixed martial arts and Thai boxing and football where they're incredibly strenuous, they're violent, they have a high risk of injury. And then there are sports like, badminton and shuffleboard or, curling or things where there's almost nothing in common between these two ends of the spectrum, apart from breathing, and yet these are all sports. And so if you use a word like religion, you're essentially doing that. To talk about Islam in the same breath as Buddhism or Jainism is to miss some crucial distinctions between doctrines. So yeah, I don't know if that addressed your question, but you almost never run into this in English, but we have a real poverty of vocabulary on this topic, and so there's just not a truly unembarrassing word that names this area of endeavor.
Right. Well, I guess I made sure that I would not ask any more than two questions on the subject of terminology, because it can be a big waste of time often and doesn't really get anywhere. But
yeah.
My dad has read a number of your books and writings pretty closely, and he wanted me to pose a question to you, and I'll just quote it because it's easier that way. He says that you have famously criticized faith, notoriously criticized it in many eyes. Yet when you describe your experiences and invite others to try in what you call spirituality, I hear a call to faith. It is a different kind of faith, as contrasted from the faith you criticize, but apropos of the famous statement about faith, which is, quote, faith is taking the first step even when you don't see the whole staircase. I think many people would interpret waking up as a call to a different kind of faith, grounded in reality and reason, yet mindful of the limitations of reason and past experience. Could a reframing of faith or religion be similarly useful as your attempts in this book to convince people that they should reform or at least accept the idea that spirituality is not necessarily a bad thing?
Right. Well, that's a very good question. I think there's two issues there that we should untangle. One is that this term faith it's very easy to get confused about what it means. It means different things in different contexts,
right.
And even in the end of faith, I was clear that it wasn't every usage of faith that I was objecting to. So when you have a friend who's depressed, and you say, "Listen, you just got to have faith in yourself," that on my account is not a crazy thing to say. And of course, that's just you're advocating a positive attitude in the face of uncertainty, and that's, we all need that kind of faith, and there's just nothing objectionable about urging that kind of faith on other people. And the faith of, as I think I said earlier, the faith of scientific hypothesis is not, I don't think it's really appropriately called faith, but it is a kind of openness to inquiry. It's just, let's look here and see if there's something worth looking at. let's follow this recipe for a cake and see if we actually get a cake out of it. I have faith that we will, because I've read many books that tell me exactly how good the cake was that they got by this process, and I don't have any reason to believe that these people were lying. So if you want to call that faith, fine, but that's not the faith that we're dealing with when we're talking about faith that the Bible was authored by the creator of the universe, or faith that the Quran was.
Right.
Here we're getting truth claims that are highly implausible, for which there is no good evidence, and against which there really are mountains of evidence at this point, that certain of our books could not have been produced by human beings, and that they're perfect in all their parts, despite their obvious self-contradictions and the ways in which they contradict the last 150 years of science. These are very strenuous claims about the way reality is. And one distinction I would make between spirituality, in my sense, and religion, is that spirituality doesn't entail any claims about the cosmos or about the metaphysics based on experience. And this is where someone like Deepak Chopra gets things totally wrong, in my view. So he'll tell you that if you close your eyes in meditation and transcend your feeling of self and feel at one with the cosmos, well, then that tells you something about the cosmos. That tells you that you're identical to the one mind that preceded the Big Bang. Well, it tells you nothing of the kind. I mean, there's nothing you're experiencing with in the darkness of your closed eyes that tells you anything about the Big Bang, or much less what preceded it. You're not doing cosmology when you're meditating. And
this is a literal claim of his.
Yes, absolutely. And these are kind of quasi-religious claims, and this is what every religious person does when he begins to feel very good in the context of his methodology. So if you're a Christian praying in church and you begin to feel bliss or rapture, or you lose your sense of self and you just feel at one with the universe, well, how are you going to interpret that experience? Well, very likely you're going to interpret it through the lens of Christian doctrine. You're going to think that Jesus Christ, a first century carpenter who had the bad luck to get crucified, managed to survive his death, and now he's taking an interest in the fate of your soul. But now, of course, a Hindu praying to Shiva is going to have a very different interpretation, and a Buddhist will have a different interpretation, as will a Muslim. And these interpretations are totally irreconcilable. There is no way for the Muslim's interpretation to square with the interpretation of a Hindu. They mutually repudiate one another in every particular, and yet they're having the same kind of experiences. So the deeper principle is that the human mind is susceptible to these kinds of experiences. It's possible to feel better than you ever have in your life. And it's possible to have your mind grow so concentrated that thoughts subside and that you feel like consciousness is just an ocean of peace. The illegitimate move is then to say, well, okay, this tells me something about the cosmos. This tells me that the energy of love pervades the entire galaxy. It doesn't. This tells me that my Bible really was authored by the creator of the universe. It doesn't. These are all the claims that are illegitimate, and yet the claim that's not illegitimate, and the claim which, if your father, you know, wants to call this a faith claim, fine, but it's a very different sort of claim. The claim is that these experiences are possible. These experiences simply await your attention, and there's a recipe for having these experiences, and they tell us nothing about the veracity of any specific religious doctrines, but they do tell us about the human mind. They tell us that the human mind is susceptible to various changes, and as I argue in the book, this has to be understood in the context of our growing scientific conversation about the mind.
Well, I'm very sad to say it, but we are almost out of time, so I'm going to have to ask my last question here.
Sure.
I wish we had more, maybe like another hour or two, but we don't. So I guess the thing that I would really like to know, and I think many other people would like to know as well, is considering your life so far as a writer and public speaker on some of the most important matters, it requires you to think frequently about some of the worst things in the world. Like you said, the main thing that seemed to really launch you in the direction of this nonfiction writing with the end of faith was the attacks of September 11th. So with that going on, and with our awareness of all the other horrors that are brought upon people in the name of religion, like ISIS, for example, not to mention the things like climate change, economic structures, with all of this out there and constantly thinking and writing about it, how do you in your life find the balance between practicing meditation and getting yourself to that point of peace while also dealing with reading or thinking or writing about such difficult and painful subjects?
Yeah, well, I you know, it's on any given day, if you ask me whether I found the balance, I as often as not will be able to say that I haven't. I mean, my days are filled with seem to be tiny emergencies like anyone else. You know, it's just, you know, just as I think I write in the book, you know, I spend much of my life feeling like I'm in a neurotic trance, you know, and this is just what it's like to be lost in thought. I mean, thoughts have that character, that we're tending to enforce the mediocrity of our own captive attention, you know, in every moment. And the difference, however, is that once you learn to really meditate, once you actually can break the spell of thought, you can enjoy real freedom from this process, if only for a few moments at a time. But those moments of punctuating the storm of discursivity is, I mean, those are a huge relief. And I also find that suffering, once you have this ability to truly be mindful, to truly kind of step out of the stream of your reactivity, then what happens is that painful experience actually becomes a kind of alarm clock. I mean, because it's very easy to go to sleep when everything is pleasant and you're just, you know, eating one bite of ice cream after the next and you've got no cause to complain. When things become uncomfortable, then your suffering becomes the reminder that there's an alternative to just thinking about why you're so angry at person X or you know, how anxious you are about something that's coming up in the future. And so suffering then becomes its own a call to look more closely at the nature of experience. And it's a tremendous relief to be able to step out, you know, wake up from the dream of being yourself, if only for a few moments at a time. So the process for me is one of continually waking up to a kind of clear moment of seeing the present moment as though for the first time. And then, you know, a few moments later, I go to sleep like everyone else, and I'm just lost in thought and whatever that, you know, like anyone else, I'm a hostage to whatever the emotional implications of that thought are. Again, it's like the practice of meditation. You just have to continually start again. And there's no one's keeping score. You know, it's always just now is your opportunity to wake up. And what has preceded this moment is, in this moment, just a memory, is just a thought about the past. And you can drag it around with you for as long as you want, but there's always an opportunity to just drop it and live this moment of your life as though it were the first.
A great way to close for today's show. Thanks so much for coming on the show today, Mr. Harris.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Matthew. Thanks a lot.
So that was Sam Harris, the author of the new book, Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion, coming out on September 9th. Be sure to visit his website, samharris.org. And that's it for us on Equal Time for Free Thought today. If you missed any part of this program or would like to listen again or share it with friends, visit our website at equaltimeforfreethought.org. Thanks for listening, and remember to tune in, pay it forward, and question everything.